Here at Fight the New Drug, we talk a lot about the impact pornography can have on mental health, relationships, sexual health, and the world around us. And if you've felt that impact personally, it's important to know this. You're not alone. That's why Relay exists. Relay is an app designed to give you real support as you work toward lasting change. It connects you with a small, private group of people who understand what you're going through, people who show up when it matters. Relay isn't about shame or judgment. It's about accountability, encouragement, and learning how to move forward together. And if anonymity matters to you, Relay has you covered. No names, just support. If you're ready to stop doing this alone, try Relay for free today at ftnd.org/joinrelay. Can I be honest for a second? A lot of people who listen to this podcast already know they want to quit porn. That's not the problem. The problem is doing it consistently, when no one's watching, when it's difficult, when it's late, when you're stressed. Instead of just relying on willpower, rely on our friends at Relay. Relay gives you structure, tools, support, connection. So you're not fighting alone and starting over every week. If that sounds like what you've been missing, check it out at ftnd.org/joinrelay.
Pornography today looks very different than it did even a decade ago. Algorithms now shape what people see. Extreme content is more accessible than ever. And emerging technologies like AI are creating entirely new forms of exploitation and abuse. In this episode, we're joined by Claire McGlynn, professor of law at Durham University and one of the leading experts on violence against women and girls. Together, we discuss how pornography influences cultural norms, why certain behaviors are becoming increasingly normalized, the rise of voyeuristic and non-consensual content, and what AI could mean for the future of online harm. If you've ever wondered how pornography shapes the way people understand sex, consent, and relationships, this conversation is an important one. With that, let's jump in. We hope you enjoy this episode of Consider Before Consuming.
Claire, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to having this conversation with you. Can you introduce yourself and the work that you do as an expert on violence against women and girls, telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this work?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the podcast today. I'm Claire McGlynn, and I'm a professor of law at Durham University in the UK. My expertise is around violence against women and girls, and particularly online abuse and the legal regulation of pornography. What I've done really for the last 10 years or so is I've seen how there's so many gaps in the law, and the law just fails women so many times. And what my work is doing is trying to identify those gaps and then work with others to strengthen the law to better protect women and girls.
Yeah, it's amazing. And this work is so needed in the work that we do at Fight the New Drug, educating on the harmful effects of pornography. Violence against women and girls is certainly a large part of the scope that we address. When you look at the current digital landscape, you've talked about how porn today operates more like a tech industry than something niche. How do algorithms shape what people see on porn platforms? And why does that matter for the kind of content that becomes quote unquote normal?
I think this is a really important point you raise. I think it's really vital that we understand that the porn landscape today is so different from what it was 10 or 20 years ago. And the algorithms are key to that, as you say, because 20 years or so ago, an individual would maybe think about what sort of pornography do I want to watch? And they'd then have to go out and find it, and it would take quite a lot of effort. But now, the pornography that most people watch is what's fed to them by the algorithms of these big porn companies, and all of their aim and motivation is to make money. So you get them trying to keep you engaged in the platform. And they do that by feeding you more extreme content, more abusive content, very different content. And just like with social media, this is what we get fed. So it's not necessarily an individual choice. So I think that's what's really important to understand. It's the very large companies choosing what we want to see. And then we're almost getting sucked into it. You know, but the thing is, and you've probably found this in your work, people don't really like to acknowledge that, you know. Everyone likes to think that, especially in pornography, they're looking at what they really like and what they want to see. And if you say to them, that's actually just what the big platforms are wanting you to watch, it doesn't feel right and it doesn't feel good. So it's sometimes quite a challenging message to get across.
Right. And it's so interesting because so many people accept that that's true for social media, where they understand the algorithms a bit more. But there is a gap that we've seen as well in understanding how that is true within pornography. And we'll talk about this a little bit more in a moment. But when we consider the age that so many people are exposed to pornography today, those algorithms are dictating sexual templates rather than the other way around, as you have mentioned. You've written about recurring patterns in mainstream porn today. What are some of the most common patterns that you're seeing?
So I think that's, so when we talk about the patterns, I think that follows from what we've just been discussing as well, because instead of mainstream pornography being this kind of vast range of all sorts of different types of pornography, in fact, it's a relatively narrow focus and narrow scope. I mean, I guess my work focuses on what we might call some of the more extreme material. So patterns, you know, material around family relationships and incest, around adult actors who are made to look like very young girls. Some of the material around strangulation, sometimes people call it choking particularly. And then I guess there's the whole range of kind of rape porn or non-consensual porn. So, but I mean, that's just, you know, scratching the surface. I suppose rough sex, rough porn would be another kind of category, really, that could actually cover quite a lot of what I've just described. But some of that will include the material, you know, to do with like spitting and gagging and, you know, the facials, lots of that sort of, yeah, material.
Yeah. Right. And so many people often think of those kind of categories as niche things, but really what we are seeing is they are patterns. Mm. They are patterns that we're seeing across so much pornographic content that is so easily accessible online, which is different from, you know, pre-internet pornography. It really has escalated and changed in such a dramatic way. I want to go back to choking specifically that you mentioned a moment ago. You've pointed out in your work that choking is often introduced without warning in real life encounters. And that's something that we've heard about as well from individuals who have been, you know, on a first date with someone and they kiss and the teenagers, and then the boy chokes the girl and says, well, I thought that's what she wanted, because this is something that has been presented to them as normal. What does that tell us about how people are interpreting cues or expectations in the moment?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting issue, especially when we talk about it in relation to younger people and maybe even teenagers, because some of the data, I mean, there's a survey from the United Kingdom that, you know, around a third to a half of those who are engaged in choking or strangulation aren't seeking consent in advance for that activity. Now, on the one hand, it is shocking. It's really concerning. But on the other hand, it's also not surprising when you think about how common it is, because in pornography, it's presented as just like an ordinary, you know, another kind of standard part of sexual activity, not something that is so particularly serious you need to discuss and get consent in advance. So I guess what I mean is I it's not that I understand when people, it's mostly men, don't ask for consent. It's more just that in the cultural world we're living of mainstream pornography, it's kind of understandable. But I guess the other point about that is that for many women as well, though, they say they feel uncomfortable in this, you know, being choked or strangled, but it's still consensual. You know, so it's not that many women are saying I was, forced or assaulted, but they're saying they're uncomfortable and they didn't really want it. And for me, what this tells me is that consent is not the be all and the end all around sexual activity. You know, consent is like a minimum floor. You need consent. But consent doesn't actually tell us what is ethical, what is good, what is positive, and any of those other things that one might look for in sexual activity, for example. You know, so I think people often, you know, talk about going to like to the dentist or something. It sounds, I can consent to getting my teeth drilled and the dentist, but I don't really want it. So I'm still consenting, but it's not actually wanted. And I think we maybe need to think about consent in that way in some of these contexts.
Yeah. And I think there's, I'd love your take on the idea that some women, especially young girls, will consent to having an intimate experience with a partner. And so because they consented to having an intimate sexual experience, there's this idea that they've blanket consented to any and every act that may occur in that instance. And, someone's idea of what they're consenting to might be kissing or making out, and then suddenly they're being choked or something they certainly didn't consent to, but they've consented to this experience. And if that just is what they believe is part of it without knowing, especially for young girls, I think that's where things get really messy in terms of understanding consent within those instances. What are your thoughts about that?
I think you're right. And I think what it means is we don't have, and many young people don't have as rich enough an understanding that consent isn't just something that, you give it, say, the beginning of an encounter and that's it forever after.
Right.
It does need to be something that's ongoing. And, you're checking in with your partner about what's happening there. I think it also goes to, when we've just talked about rough sex. So there's research that's done with younger people when you say, what do you mean by rough sex? And people give all sorts of different answers, because it's such a huge sort of category. But what that means is that even if you had a discussion with someone about, rough sex, or like, that means so many different things to different people that, you would need to, or what ought to happen is deeper engagement in what that actually means. Because, what rough sex means, I mean, let alone whether, so much of that can be problematic. But even putting that to one side for now, there's just no agreement on what that actually is. Some of that's about education, isn't it? It's about trying to get young people to better understand what consent is. Although, like I say, then going beyond just the minimum consent to what does someone actually want to do?
Right. And I'm glad that you brought up terminology specifically, because you've written about how using language like choking can actually soften what's happening physically. So how does that kind of language shape how people process the experience afterward?
Many people, before me have talked about the use of the term choking, which is what's often really common, but actually what we're talking about is strangulation. I think that term is not used because, frankly, it sounds concerning, doesn't it? what do you call someone who engages in that? You call them a strangler. And we're used to that term being used, in scary movies, isn't it? So choking is kind of used almost to minimize it in a way. And I think it just adds to the sense that this is okay and this is normal. And then if you are, say, a young woman who afterwards is thinking, this is really uncomfortable, I really don't like this, but it's called choking and everyone talks about, choke me on TikTok, or frankly, you go onto Amazon and it's choke me daddy t-shirts and all the rest of it. Am I supposed to actually want and enjoy this? And I think the language of choking doesn't help us in that debate. We need to try and talk about strangulation, frankly.
Right. And for someone who maybe thinks those two terms are interchangeable, can you describe the difference between the two?
Yeah. So strangulation is the technical term for the external pressure on the neck, whereas choking is describes getting something stuck in your throat. So, you know, if you eat something and you're coughing, that's choking. Whereas the external pressure on the neck is the strangulation. So that's the medical difference between the two.
Right. And that really is a very significant difference in what someone's experiencing, especially without any discussion about it or knowledge about it prior to it occurring. You know, we're just seeing rates of this type of pornographic content and the influence it's having on individuals increase pretty dramatically. And so it is really important that we're having these nuanced conversations about what that is. I want to ask you about, there's a recent study that assesses rates of self-reported sexual aggression of men, and that highlights behaviors like persistence or continuing to escalate physically, even when there isn't clear verbal agreement. It says that 91.5% of 18 to 34-year-old men, quote, reported having recently used at least one of the strategies to get a woman to have sex who they knew did not want sex and had not consented. Most of these occasions, 65%, resulted in successfully forcing the woman into sex, end quote. So in your view, what's shaping whether those behaviors are seen as normal versus crossing a line?
Well, Yes, without a doubt. I mean, the pornography and the pornographic landscape is quite likely shaping those behaviors, because what we see in mainstream pornography, and it's important to keep emphasizing that in a way, isn't it? I'm talking about the pornography that's on the largest porn sites that's fed to millions of people every day. Non-consent is a key part of that, whether you might be talking about waking someone up after the sleeping, or someone who's perhaps drugged, or, sexual activity starts without consent and then the woman is seen to enjoy it. So what else that study is emphasizing is the kind of, it's aggression, it's the pressure, it's the consistent pressure that eventually you'll get there. And of course, that's a key facet of a lot of pornography. In other words, even when the women are seen to object at first, eventually they love it. that's the kind of story. And so, again, in a way, that's what men are taking on board. Now, if you were talking about much younger men, I'd be slightly more understanding in the sense of, you know, they've not yet developed a sense of what's right and wrong. But by the time we're getting to, you know, older men, late teens and into their 20s, and they're using these strategies, they know what they're doing. You know, they do. Even though they're getting the norms and the ideas from porn, they still know what they're doing. It's a really disturbing study in that sense.
Yeah, you brought up the concept of sleep porn, and there has been more attention recently on sleep porn and voyeuristic content. What do you think allows that kind of content to exist on mainstream platforms without pushback?
It's very interesting, isn't it? I think there's a sense that sleep porn is not actually rape porn, but that's what I would call it. So there's been lots of, working campaigns around to get to criticize rape porn. And actually, on some of the mainstream sites, you can't actually search now for rape porn. It will bring up a kind of error message. But what you can find is this sort of material you're talking about, sleep porn. So they're asleep and you wake them up with sexual activity. And I mean, I suppose it's cyclical. So you see that in porn. So people don't take it as seriously as if it's rape. They don't take it as seriously as if it is rape, and so you see it on the porn sites. And I think what I find most surprising about it as well is that some of the largest porn sites, they have terms and conditions, and Pornhub has this, where they actually mention it and they say that it's not allowed unless the actor wakes up within a reasonable time frame. And I think, do you know what? No sexual offence law I know says it's only rape if you don't wake her up within a reasonable time. It's always rape if you have sex with someone when they're asleep because they've not consented. And yeah, I don't understand it. You're right that there's slightly more attention on this now, particularly in Europe, following a case in France of Gisèle Pelicot, whose husband drugged her and, you know, large numbers of men had sex with her while she, raped her rather, while she was asleep. And he was looking at, you know, her ex-husband was looking at sleep porn and talked about that in advance. So there is more recognition now, I think, about that reality of what's happening to many women. But for some reason, yeah, it's still on those websites. And there's all sorts of versions, you know, it's kind of be asleep, sleep. There's also things called time stop porn, where, you know, the woman kind of stops and freezes and the man can do anything to her, which is just a kind of another variation of it, really.
Yeah. And I think with these things, you know, with Gisèle's case and, you know, the recent CNN piece that has covered this drug facilitated rape, essentially the stories about how many different women have experienced these horrific, horrific things with a partner they trusted. And then, you know, finding out what has been happening to them that they're not even aware of because they are drugged or medicated to the point where, you know, they know something has happened to them, but they don't know what. And certainly there is an influence from pornography. And in many cases, those women are being filmed by their partners. And then that content is being uploaded to sites. And so we've seen a lot of media attention around that recently following that piece where, you know, there was for a week or two, there was uproar online from people who were learning about this for the first time and learning about websites and, you know, the ways that communities of men were encouraging each other to participate in this behavior. And then it kind of dissipates again, you know, people are up in arms about it and then kind of forget. And it doesn't, it's not going away. It's not that we've tackled the issue and it's gone now. So what would your advice be for anyone who kind of learns about these things and is shocked and then, you know, forgets and moves on?
Well, at one level, it's understandable that some people do move on because living with and understanding, as you know from your work, from working every day in the reality of this sort of thing happening is really hard.
Yes.
So at one level, I kind of understand why some people do want to move on. And also for many women as well, it's almost a safety mechanism. You know, who of us wants to really think that this is happening on such a mass scale? And in fact, that it is, you know, the men around us who could be doing this. So, yeah, I guess that's just to say I can understand why people would want to move on.
Yeah.
But at a political level, it's unacceptable, isn't it? It's our politicians need to act and our regulators need to act because this is happening at scale. And it's on them to take action, whether that's relating to the sexual assaults, whether it's the websites that are taking and sharing this material, prosecuting men where they can find them, but also then targeting this kind of material being on mainstream porn sites.
Right. That's very well said. I want to ask you a little bit about kind of legal processes and responses to these types of events. So you've written about cases where quote unquote rough sex is used as a legal defense. And how does the framing of plausible deniability shape what juries or the public see as credible or acceptable in those situations?
Yeah, so we've seen this in many countries, again, around the world, a kind of development over the last 20 years when for example, women have died at the hands of men whose defense is this was just rough sex gone wrong. In other words, they weren't therefore responsible. It was an accident in a sense. And the problem is, as you highlight, is that over recent years, that defense has become more plausible because people are more used to that rough sex being normal. And so they're more used to the idea that, in fact, it could have been rough sex gone wrong. And of course, that might just be the case in some instances. It's possible. I'm not saying it's not possible. But what we've seen is an alarming rise in the use of that kind of defense. And what you have is the closer the criminal trial just kind of almost mirrors the stories that you've seen in mainstream pornography. And so juries sitting there are not thinking, oh my God, that is extraordinary behavior. They're thinking, well, they're probably not even rationalizing it this way, but it just sounds like, you know, almost everyday normal sexual activity. So yeah, it's played into those debates in really difficult and harmful ways. And we've had cases in the United Kingdom where, you know, some of the acts have been so vicious and extraordinary, but the men have still been let off. And we never really know why, because we can't, you know, investigate what the jury thinks. But without a doubt, there's a real concern that this normalization of rough sex online is part of that issue, without a doubt.
Right. And just the idea, too, that if, you know, if that can even be used as a legal defense, it takes away the responsibility to get consent, to have those conversations mm-hmm. when engaging in any kind of sexual encounter, but especially one that is, you know, maybe more physically violent mm-hmm. or more risky. And if it's like, well, I can just, mm-hmm. you know, say it was an accident. If something goes wrong, it removes the responsibility and accountability of having sexual encounters in a safe way, in a responsible way, seeking enthusiastic consent, seeking, you know, continued conversation about what is happening. And that's really concerning as younger people are having this normalized for them. When you look at figures like Piper Raquel or Lil Taylor or other, quote, barely legal OnlyFans stars, where there are questions around sexualization or grooming, what stands out to you about how audiences respond or seek out that kind of content?
So there's a number of issues I think you're raising there. This kind of barely legal content I find deeply troubling. It's one of the types of pornography that I think is most disturbing and actually kind of most unacceptable in a way. We have been doing a lot of work around that in the UK over the last number of months. And in my book, I try and go into quite a bit of detail about this because I just don't think people understand what we're talking about when we are saying they are actors who are 18 or over, but look, some of them incredibly young. So on the mainstream sites, I don't know about the, you know, some of the videos on OnlyFans because I've not been able to access, I've not accessed that material, but I can talk about what's on the mainstream pornography sites. And they are images of very young looking girls, 12, 13, you know, the girls might look 12, 13 years old. They're in children's underwear, children's bedclothes, surrounded by children's toys. The language is childified. And many of these scenarios are, you know, the kind of older men sneaking into, you know, late night into this child's bedroom and raping them. And because the actors are 18, this is legal it's about to stop being legal in the UK and in many countries. And it's mimicking child sexual abuse. I mean, that's what it's doing. And it's legitimizing you gaining sexual gratification from sex with a 12 or 13 year old looking girl. And what I find staggering is that that is just not automatically assumed and recognized. And that, of course, that's problematic. So we shouldn't allow it. But that right. doesn't seem to be the approach. But like I say, in the UK, we have just the law is just about to change. That kind of pornography will no longer be lawful.
Yeah, which is, it's really incredible. And, you know, as you mentioned, so many people just accept this idea that, well, everyone involved is over the age of 18, so this is totally fine. And actually, in many cases, there's no way for them to guarantee that the person on the other side of the screen is over the age of 18. even if they see something on a more mainstream stream site where they get to assume and say, well, you know, this has got to be legitimate. There's no way for them to guarantee the age of the person on the other side of the screen, especially when they're looking younger and younger, especially when we know that pornographic content exists of individuals who were trafficked into this set of circumstances, or, you know, it was someone who was under the age of 18 and forced into a scenario where this is what was filmed of them. So that's one piece of this. And then the other is, it's alarming that even if someone can say, well, they're over the age of 18, but they look 12 and they're meant to be infantilized, they're meant to be encouraging this type of behavior or relationship. You know, when people are existing in the real world, not everyone over the age of 18 looks 12. Yeah. And so if that's what they're looking for, they're going to find that in a 12-year-old, right? And so I guess I want to ask you, what impact does having this type of content or pushing this type of content have on people, how people interpret youth and attraction and boundaries?
Hey, just be honest for a second. How many times have you said that was the last time you'd watch porn? And meant it. Yeah. You're not alone. Quitting can be difficult, but it doesn't have to be. Relay is a recovery program that helps you actually break the cycle with structure, support, and real accountability. So it's not just you in your own head trying again and again. If you're ready for something different, head to ftnd.org/joinrelay and try Relay for free.
The Consider Before Consuming podcast is part of a global movement to raise awareness about the impacts of pornography using science, facts, and real stories. And because of supporters like you, these conversations stay free and accessible to millions. In fact, Fight the New Drugs podcast has reached millions of listeners worldwide, helping people better understand how porn can impact mental health, relationships, and society. But here's the thing, this work doesn't happen on its own. Every episode, every expert interview, every story you hear is made possible by donations from listeners who believe these conversations matter. So, if this podcast has helped you think differently, start a conversation, or feel less alone, consider paying it forward. You can support the podcast and the movement by making a donation today. Just visit ftnd.org/donate to give. Because when you support this work, you're helping reach millions more with the information they deserve. Together, let's change the conversation about porn.
Yeah, so I think this content, normalizes and legitimizes child sexual abuse. So it, in terms of boundaries, it removes those boundaries, I think, frankly, doesn't it? Because it sends a message that it's not as harmful, because many of these videos are about, you know, so I've talked about the ones, you know, waking up a sleeping girl, but some of the other videos like that are where these very young looking girls are very enthusiastic about having sex with much older men. So this plays into some of the kind of modus operandi, you know, the way in which child sexual abusers act. And so it reduces those boundaries and it blurs any of those lines of consent. But what I think it also does is that what we've seen from work with those who work with child sex offenders and who work in the area of child sexual abuse, sexual abuse images, what they say when I've been speaking to them is that it used to be the case that you would have there is a small group of men who have a very direct sexual interest in children, you know, what you might call paedophiles. But with the growth of the internet and this type of pornography, you've got a whole nother group of men as well who didn't necessarily even set out to look for child sexual abuse material or these very young looking girl images, but that's what they end up at because they're pushed that content or it becomes more extreme or they get more desensitized. And then what we have is there's some research that suggests, you know, about 40% of men who've watched some of this type of material then go on to try and make contact with children. It doesn't say that they're then assaulting them, but they're trying to then engage with children. So this is a real risk. So this type of content, I think, really raises the risk of child sexual abuse and child sexual abuse material. But it also, for everyone else, it legitimizes it and normalizes it so that we just don't take it as seriously. We're not as bothered when there's high rates of it. We're not as bothered when the police don't investigate it. We're not as bothered when the government doesn't put any money into children's charities, you know, et cetera. It then filters into all sorts of aspects of our culture and our life.
Right. And we know that for young people as well. We know young people are seeing pornography. We know there's, you know, this content is easily accessible and in some cases is used deliberately to groom young people to say, see, this is totally normal. So not only is it normalizing that behavior instigation from a perpetrator and adults, but it's normalizing the behavior to children who don't know any different yet, and they're being groomed to accept this child sexual abuse as well. And it's causing a lot of harm in ways that I think sometimes adults will watch pornography and say, well, you know, I'm an adult. I can tell that this person's over 18, even though they're looking younger, so I can make this educated decision. But young people can't always decipher that, and nor can adults, quite frankly. And so I think it is really, really important to sound the alarm on this. And I am so glad to hear that, you know, actions have been taken where you're at to make this type of content illegal moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right about young people as well. They won't necessarily be able to tell the difference, as well as adults, you're right, not necessarily being able to tell the difference. I mean, some of these actors are well-known porn actors. So some people watching them do know that this person is over 18. But even if you know that they're over 18, it's still a message that it's legitimate and okay to gain sexual arousal from watching sex with someone pretending to be 12 or 13 years old.
Yeah. Looking a little bit at where technology has gone with tools like X's Grok or other AI chatbots, you know, we've already seen harmful non-consensual content circulate before guardrails were in place. What does that reveal about how reactive versus preventative these systems are?
I mean, I think we knew across the board, whether we're talking about social media, porn platforms, and with AI, that they're only ever reactive to public outcry and legal cases. They do not take action to prevent and reduce harms. And the Grok case is just one of the worst in that sense, because it was so obvious that if you introduce the image capability into Grok, it was going to be used in that way. And they just simply did not put in place any sufficient guardrails to stop it happening. And it's it's really concerning. And what's interesting as well about that case, because obviously Grok is an AI chatbot. So we're seeing the development from deepfakes and then into AI. Because what also happened in lots of the Grok cases is, although in many of them you do have an individual at the one end who says to Grok, you know, like, please undress her, if you like, and it'll then produce the undressed image. But what Grok was also doing was sometimes adding to that image in other kind of sexual ways. So it was doing it itself almost. This was the chatbot. So we have, there's cases in which a prompt was surround this woman by a group of men. And it did surround her with a group of men, but also made her nude. So you've got the chatbots. And I've done some research just recently talking about how this is like chatbot driven violence against women and girls, because it's the chatbot that is, because of how it's been programmed, is driving this type of abuse. And I think this is a very concerning development we're going to see with AI becoming so common and so dominant. But, you know, this is what we've seen in other areas of social media as well, isn't it? Many of these large platforms, they only ever act and change the rules once the alarm bells have been sounded. And the people who most suffer from that tend to be women and girls and other, sometimes other minority and marginalized groups.
Right. And you've looked at, as you mentioned, how these chatbots are essentially reshaping violence against women and girls. Where do you see how these systems are introducing entirely new dynamics versus intensifying ones that were already there?
Yes. So one of the particular areas, and it connects to our discussions around pornography, is what my colleagues and I have been talking about. We call it chatbot simulated violence against women and girls, because, many of you may know that you can now create characters on some of these chatbots. For example, there's platforms like Character AI or Chub AI, and you get a choice of how you design your character. And in some of these platforms, you have a drop-down menu, for example, and you can choose that your character is going to engage in incest or sexual violence or child sexual abuse, and your character could be a 12-year-old girl. And then the individuals are then engaging sexually with these characters that they've just developed. And I'm deeply concerned about this, because this is, again, an area that seems to be going under the radar. There have been some reports, for example, in, the Washington Post and New York Times, particularly when Meta introduced a chatbot, and one of the characters they allowed and created was called Submissive Schoolgirl. And this did cause some, outcry, and that's since been changed. But Character AI and Chub AI, you can still create these deeply troubling characters. And so you're simulating these forms of abuse. Now, much of that is text-based at the moment, but I would anticipate very quickly in a few years, we're going to be talking about creating characters that are probably very lifelike and could actually also resemble real people. But then you're engaging in a sexual chat with them. You might then, record it, video it, share it online. It's deeply disturbing. And I don't think any of our legislators are yet acting on what's happening here. And we need to have a conversation as well. We need to decide what are we going to do about this? Do we think it's acceptable that you can engage, create a chat person, a chat bot that's like a 12-year-old girl and engage with her sexually? Is that okay?
Yeah. And I mean, certainly not. And it's something I want to ask you about, because it's something we've heard before, is this idea that, well, if someone who would perpetrate, sexual violence against a child has another outlet to do that where they're not actually perpetrating against a child, then we'll eliminate that problem. And what would your response to that be?
I just don't think that adds up. There's no evidence to prove that that's the case. And I think it's quite the opposite, frankly, and especially when we're talking about chatbots. Because what we're already learning about chatbots in a very short space of time is they're so immersive. They really, and any of us probably using even ChatGPT get this, when they tell us we've asked them a very good question, and we get sucked into it and we start talking to the chatbot a little bit. And so they're very immersive, they're very intense. And so if you're then engaging in any of these discussions, and of course, we've seen the repercussions sometimes with, the suicide of young people and adults. And AI psychosis is very easy to get sucked in. And so I think if you're engaging in chat with one of these chatbots that is, say, sexually violent or is, reproducing incest, I think that's going to just fuel that interest rather than try and eradicate it.
Right. Looking ahead, what concerns you most about more immersive technologies like virtual reality in this space?
So I think virtual reality and the chatbots now are obviously going to begin to merge. And virtual reality as well is one of the fastest growing areas of pornography. And that's because it is also sold on the idea of being more intense and more immersive, and therefore almost more real. So it adds that extra dimension. You're not just so with virtual reality, you're not just watching porn on a screen, but you're kind of in it. You're kind of living it. And the other thing to remember about virtual reality, in case people who don't realize, you can get physical sensations from it. So there's this technology, it's called haptic technology, and it can be gloves, it can actually be a whole body suit. And when the other person in a virtual reality game, for example, goes to like touch you, you can actually feel it on yourself. It might sound peculiar if you've never used it, but so this physical touch in virtual reality. And so if we're talking about engaging in this very real feeling, immersive, intense pornography, you're actually, you're kind of living it more as well in a way. And so, sure, that might be fine for a lot of areas. But again, my concern is when that is about sexually violent, non-consensual, or, you know, incest, child sexual abuse, you know, stories, and it then feeling that much more intense and real. I find that deeply, deeply disturbing. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, what we do know from research about pornography and, you know, frequent or compulsive pornography consumption is that individuals, because of the algorithms, because of the vast array of content available to people, over time tend to seek out this content more often and more hardcore versions of this content to kind of get that same release, which is what often leads individuals to transition from something they've consumed in pornography to acting that out in real life. And so if that same research were to apply in this instance where something has been so visceral and so real for someone, it is certainly concerning to think of what could come of that.
Yeah.
Next.
Yeah, definitely.
When you zoom out, what feels most misunderstood about how pornography is not just behavior, but how people interpret their own experiences?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think what's most misunderstood from what I've been looking at and writing about. So I've been terming what I'm looking at patriarchal porn. And that's the porn on these mainstream sites that's the most popular, the most commonly accessed. And I describe it as patriarchal porn because it does reproduce these ideas of male dominance, men's priorities, you know, men dominating women, women basically accepting and liking almost anything. And my point is that that's not just in porn, but that is what's sustaining what I see as a patriarchal world we're still living in. And it's not that every single man dominates every single woman. It's about it at structural level that there's still no equality between women and men. And I think that's what people misunderstand. They think porn is just this world of you watch a bit of pornography and then you step back into the real world. And I just don't think it's like that. I think your ideas and your way of thinking about the world is shaped by pornography that then impacts on your daily life. How do you react to your neighbor, to your boss who might be a woman, to, you know, anyone you encounter, your family members? It impacts on those behaviors, I think. And I think that's what's not understood enough.
Right. It's not a separate, this happens over here privately and no one else is affected, and then I exist in the world. You know, research has shown us this. And I mean, we've spoken with, our nonprofit's been around for 17 years. We've spoken with tens of thousands of individuals, many of whom have struggled with pornography, compulsive pornography habits themselves, or something that escalated into affairs or acting out in a sexually violent way. And the common thread between all of them is how much pornography shaped their view of the world externally, including their view of women, and how much they learned to see women as objects rather than people, as objects for their sexual gratification. And that really is what is modeled in mainstream pornography. So when you mention it affects the systems that we live in this world, it's so true. It affects the way that, you know, women are sexualized in media broadly. And certainly there are male victims of sexual violence and abuse, and men are sexualized in media as well. But when we look at the statistics of sexual violence against women, women are largely victims and men are largely perpetrators. Right. And so it is something that we have to look upstream at this root cause of pornography to truly understand.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, 100%. And I think one of the other things that I think actually another point that I think isn't understood enough is that even outside some of the really violent content I've been talking about, there's when I look at some of this and, you know, doing the research for the book, I think one thing that comes across to me is that although this is supposed to be about sexual arousal, it's not even that the men look like they're sexually aroused, because I think there's a sense of loathing from some men of women in many of these videos. It's not an exciting thrill. It's real, and you use the word visceral loathing of women. And that comes across in so many of these kinds of videos. And I can think of some in particular, but that's, so again, that I'm just trying to reinforce that idea that it's not just about sexual arousal. It isn't. It is about, right, you know, exercising power, eroticizing power exercised by men over women in a lot of these videos.
Yeah, that's very well said. If someone listening wants to think more critically about what they're seeing and unlearn some of these patterns, where's a good place to start?
My book.
No, please, please tell us about your book. I would love our listeners to know. That was a perfect answer.
there's so many places that people can go to learn more about this. There's so many organizations like yourself. There's organizations in many countries that are trying to raise awareness about this. And that includes organizations that directly target pornography, but also many women's organizations that I've worked with again over the years know and understand these links to pornography. I mean, the book that I've just written, that just published, called Exposed, tries to set out what's really out there on these platforms and then what we can do about it. So it's trying to say what is the truly awful stuff that's there, how we got there, talking about these big porn platforms, and then what we can do about it. And I wrote it because there are many of us having these conversations, and, you know, organizations like yourselves doing this work, but it still doesn't feel like it's enough of a national or international conversation or understanding of what's really going on. So I wanted to just play my part in that. So I'd hope that any reader of that book would gain a better understanding of what's going on and some ideas and suggestions about how we might take some steps to try and challenge what's happening.
Right. And I'm so glad you mentioned your book. It really does cover these issues in such a helpful and articulate way. But I want to ask you, in doing the research, preparing for your book, releasing that, what do you think is kind of the most compelling information for someone who's maybe entirely new to learning about this topic, or has never seen pornography as something that is, you know, connected to violence against women, or who doesn't understand the degree to which violence against women and girls is affecting our societies? What are you, whether it's statistics or stories, what do you really feel is the most compelling thing that came out of that for you?
I mean, gosh, it's difficult to pin down, to be honest. I think, unfortunately, some of the research studies and statistics are important. You know, whether that's about research I did, which showed, you know, how common sexually violent material is on the mainstream porn sites, or some of the studies following young people showing the real risk of porn use for those going on to commit sexually violent acts. But the stories are powerful too. You know, it's when young women, and I've spoken to a number of young women in my work, and they feel this sense of unease or just uncomfortable, and things don't feel right, but they think it's only them. right. without realizing there's it there it's not just them. It's because of these messages that are being fed to them. So yeah, I don't think I've got a straightforward answer. I mean, because it's a very complicated topic, isn't it? Let's face it.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And I appreciate that answer. I do think it's, you really spoke to all of the facets that we often speak to in the work that we do is, you know, the research is so compelling and there's research about this side of this and about this side of this and then stories about this side of this. And this is such a complicated issue that it affects so much more than people think. Yeah. So many more areas of our society, of the way we view gender, of the way that we coexist, the way we think about sexual violence, the way we think about sexual experiences in general, about healthy sex, about relationships, about, you know, even domestic violence or situations. It really is such a robust topic. Even, you know, we've heard from individuals who worked with law enforcement in the United States that were actually related to, you know, pursuing violent gangs or, you know, focusing on drugs. And in almost every instance, they encountered the individuals who were violent. Pornography was part of the equation for them. And that's something I think about so often because I think for many people that would feel really untethered. Yes. And this is really something that's just at the root of so many different ways people are affected by this. So it makes sense you couldn't think of an individual instance when you wrote an entire book to really convey, you know, the most compelling information. You mentioned earlier that being in the weeds of this all the time is, you know, heavy and can be so difficult. And certainly writing a book about this and doing the work that you do, you're in the weeds of that a lot. What gives you hope when you think about the future? What gives you hope that these patterns can shift?
So I think the very idea of hope I think is really important. And that's what I hang on to. The writer, Rebecca Solnit, talks a lot about how we need hope. And she talks about hope. Well, she doesn't use these phrases. This is my phrasing of it. But hope being like a political act. In other words, we don't give in to the despair. Because our opponents, whether they're the large porn platforms, the social media giants, they want us to feel hopeless, as if there's no point in acting, there's no point in doing anything, because that's great for them. They would win with that. So having hope that we can make some changes is absolutely critical, because it's a political act that we're going to carry on and we're going to keep making those changes, because we can, you know, we can. And it might not be on the scale we want to. And I can certainly say that one of the more challenging aspects of writing the book is realizing that over 20, 30 years in this space, we've not moved far enough. We have moved, but not far enough. So I can feel despair, without a doubt. And looking at some of this porn does make you feel despair. But I do try and balance that with hope, because in the work you're doing, you're helping individuals. I'm supporting individuals. Each individual makes a difference that we can help. And we are making some strides and some gains. And we have to just keep hoping for that.
Right. And I love, just to reinforce that idea, you know, these major mainstream porn giants, really, they do benefit by normalizing this to a degree that it's actually your not normal if you have a problem with pornography. It's so normalized. And so they do want individuals who are working, you know, to combat these harms to feel alone in this. But, you know, we are a movement with millions of people over, you know, nearly two decades now. And as you mentioned earlier, there are so many organizations working on so many different facets of these issues. There are so many people doing their part individually, having one conversation here that can change, you know, the outcome of something down the road. Yeah. And the ripple effect of that is really, really significant. And so it's so important for all of us, I think, to remember. We had a podcast guest on once that said, when I asked him this question, he said, this is a human problem with a human solution. Yeah. And I think about it so often because it really is something that we can actually make a difference about. But it does take all of us to kind of stay aware and engage and push for that change that we believe can happen.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Well, Claire, thank you so much for joining me today. Your book is so wonderful, and I would love to continue this conversation for several hours to utilize your expertise on these topics. I would encourage any of our listeners to look into your resources. Is there anywhere you want to direct our listeners today to learn more about your work?
So I have a website that is www.clairemcglynn.com. I'm also on Instagram. I try to use TikTok. I'm not as successful on TikTok, I would like to say. But yeah, in Instagram or LinkedIn, I'm there, and they can follow some of my work and ideas, and obviously the book that's just come out. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And for our listeners, we encourage you to continue considering before consuming. And for more conversations like this, please like and subscribe.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Consider Before Consuming. Consider Before Consuming is brought to you by Fight the New Drug. Fight the New Drug is a non-religious and a non-legislative organization that exists to provide individuals the opportunity to make an informed decision regarding pornography by raising awareness on its harmful effects using only science, facts, and personal accounts. Check out the episode notes for resources mentioned in this episode. If you find this podcast helpful, consider subscribing and leaving a review. Thanks again for listening. We invite you to increase your self-awareness, look both ways, check your blind spots, and consider before consuming.
Here at Fight the New Drug, we talk a lot about the impact pornography can have on mental health, relationships, sexual health, and the world around us. And if you've felt that impact personally, it's important to know this. You're not alone. That's why Relay exists. Relay is an app designed to give you real support as you work toward lasting change. It connects you with a small, private group of people who understand what you're going through, people who show up when it matters. Relay isn't about shame or judgment. It's about accountability, encouragement, and learning how to move forward together. And if anonymity matters to you, Relay has you covered. No names, just support. If you're ready to stop doing this alone, try Relay for free today at ftnd.org/joinrelay. Can I be honest for a second? A lot of people who listen to this podcast already know they want to quit porn. That's not the problem. The problem is doing it consistently, when no one's watching, when it's difficult, when it's late, when you're stressed. Instead of just relying on willpower, rely on our friends at Relay. Relay gives you structure, tools, support, connection. So you're not fighting alone and starting over every week. If that sounds like what you've been missing, check it out at ftnd.org/joinrelay.